Hello and welcome to the debate on France 24. Tonight, 72 hours from the bombing of Beirut and the killing of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader and figurehead of the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants for 30 years. Well, Israeli airstrikes have continued relentlessly on three fronts at the same time in Lebanon, Gaza and Yemen. Israel's military thinks it has Hezbollah on the ropes. Assassination after assassination, the senior chain of command effectively wiped out, according to the US. The Hamas leader in Lebanon killed today. Central Beirut hit for the first time too. Leaders of another Palestinian militant group killed. Israel's opposition leader, former defense minister Benny Gantz, says it's a moment of opportunity, one that can weaken what he called Iran's ring of fire, with proxies surrounding the country. Now, according to reports in the Washington Post tonight and CBS News as well, Israel has told Washington it is planning a limited ground operation in Lebanon. We're going to analyse tonight the many questions of where this conflict stands, the humanitarian situation for almost a million displaced Lebanese, and where this conflict could be heading next. With me on the panel, let's bring in Dominique Tricand, former head of French military mission to the UN. Pleasure to have you here tonight. Dominique, tell me what struck you the most. I'm going to bring in Ketevan Gorgiastani in a minute. Just tell me, Dominique, what struck you the most about the sequence of events of the past few days?
I think the sequence was very interesting with the pagers, talkie-walkie, and then strikes, different strike, and the major one on Friday evening, yes, with the head of the Hezbollah. In fact, initially we thought that it will be only the military branch which will be defeated, but in fact the Israeli decided to cut the head of the Hezbollah, meaning that they no longer expect any negotiation and they have to kill the political master of the Hezbollah. So that's, which was interesting. It's really a big change in the fact that Israel is not only fighting military terrorists, but also want to disband all the party who was threatening Israel in the north.
We're going to get on to you as well with all of your years of analysis, military experience. Just the thread, perhaps the AI used, the communications used as well. We'll talk tonight about that. Ketevan's with us, international affairs editor. Great to have you on the programme. You've been looking this week at the US position on all of this.
Yes, well, the U.S., the messaging there is still we want to avoid escalation, and we believe that diplomacy is the only path forward. That's something Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, repeated today. His words were diplomacy remains the best and only path to achieve stability in the region. But what was very interesting was the sort of offhand comment by the President of the United States, Joe Biden, just earlier today after a speech on the hurricane, so nothing to do with the situation in the Middle East. But he was asked, are you comfortable with this reporting that there is a likelihood of a military ground operation by the Israeli army into Lebanon? And his response was, I'm comfortable with them stopping. We need a ceasefire now. So it is a pretty strong sentence, strong rhetoric coming out of the U.S. president. But at the same time, we're seeing over the past few days or weeks that their work on sort of diplomacy and trying to rein in the Israeli response and trying to avoid escalation is not necessarily working, at least to the extent that they would like, which is a ceasefire.
Ketevan, thank you. Another perspective we will want to hear tonight from Tel Aviv, Colonel Miri Eisen, former IDF Deputy Head of Combat Intelligence Corps, assistant to the Director of Military Intelligence. Miri, great to have you on the programme. Tell me about the atmosphere in Tel Aviv since the death of Hassan Nasrallah.
So I'm going to push back a bit at what I just heard right now. I would not call Hassan Nasrallah a political leader. Hassan Nasrallah was certainly a leader. He was certainly an orator. And what he was talking about was most definitely not just the annihilation of the state of Israel, but as a leader, he was more than willing and leading using terrorist tactics, not just against Israel, but worldwide in Argentina and different places around Europe. So I push back on the political leader. Inside Israel, there isn't a sense of joy. What there is a sense that Israel, at least, is on the initiative. Hezbollah, those forces under Hassan Nasrallah that we're seeing right now, have attacked Israel every single day since October 8th. They have fired over 8,000 rockets into Israel before the last 2 weeks. And that's like on the side. It's as if nobody noticed that. And for me, as somebody who has so many friends who were evacuated from the north on October 8th, not in the last 2 weeks, they haven't been in their homes for the last 11 and a half months. Going on the initiative against Hezbollah is an important component in enabling the possibility to arrive at that ceasefire that all of us want to arrive at. But I need my friends to be able to go back home. And for them to go back home, you cannot have Radwan fighting forces, those terror forces that they're so proud of. They show them in lots of open films. You cannot have them on the border right next to Israel. They are ready and willing to attack, to kidnap, to do the same kind of event that we saw on October 7th.
Okay, Mary, you talk about the need for people to get back, the 60,000 or so Israelis. Perhaps that gives us a link to what might happen during this programme, during the evening, perhaps, according to the CBS and according to Washington Post, that there may be a ground offensive. I want to begin the programme, though, with an account of life for displaced Lebanese in central Beirut, the lively, bustling city of Beirut that so many people know and love, in parts barely recognisable today, say those who live there. Shops shuttered, families sleeping on the streets of the Corniche by the port, the main square too. Doha Sabah comes from the south of Lebanon. She's now in the capital with her husband and two-year-old son. Her cousin killed in a missile strike. Her father needs around-the-clock care after a seizure. He's in Beirut. Doha, great to have you on the programme with us. Tell us about your situation. And I know you're in central Beirut. You will have well heard the strikes of the past few hours and days.
Actually, my situation is like the situation of many Lebanese. I might be more lucky because I have a ceiling above me, but in the streets there are thousands of Lebanese who had to flee directly their houses without the ability of taking their belongings with them, their money or any of their belongings. And there are Syrian refugees. This is another aspect of the crisis that nobody talks about. We have in Lebanon more than 1,500 registered Syrian refugees. Maybe the number is way more better, greater when we don't speak about the non-registered. And all of these are now on the streets. The international community has promised them that they will be living safely in Lebanon. And all of them now are on the streets without any help, without any aid, and without any ceiling. So it's heartbreaking to see my people in the streets. It's heartbreaking to see that maybe we don't have the ability to go back to our houses. Many houses in the south are now reduced into rubble. I don't know exactly the situation of my own house that I had to leave actually in October 8th as well last year, because when we speak always about people being displaced from Israel in October 8th, we missed to say that also in South Lebanon there were 90,000 southern Lebanese who were displaced at the same time. And in October 8th, two journalists, one from Reuters and one from a French agency, were targeted also in Lebanon. There are many things that the narrative always miss, but that's mainly what shocked Lebanese, that they are always framed in a certain way. I have now to deal with a child that is sitting all the day in the house. He was very happy when we came from France. He's starting a new life in school, and now he doesn't have that ability anymore, and I don't think that the schools will open anymore. I don't know how to explain the bombings he's hearing all the time. When the big bomb, when 80 tons of bombs were dropped into Lebanon, it's not only the sound, but there was also a earthquake accompanying that. My son stayed for more than 6 hours, not able to talk any word, and I was really worried, and he slept that night without us explaining anything to him. And I don't know how to resolve this for him. Yeah. He was having a beautiful life back in France. He's used to that.
Doha, can I ask you?
Yes.
You talk about you trying to start a new life. You were in Paris. You came back. I think I'm right to say your dad had had a seizure. He went to hospital in Beirut. And after the pager attacks, he had to leave hospital early because there were so many people heading into the hospitals with serious injuries. Now, what will you do? Given we hear the city, everything's shuttered, schools closed for the moment, people sleeping on the streets, will you stay?
But I have the responsibility toward my dad. My dad needs specific care, daily care, and follow up with the doctors, actually, something we are not able to provide him at this moment because the hospitals are overloaded, and he had a brain surgery, and he have a cancer case that we should be following on. And at the moment, we are not able to do that. My father right now needs psychological support as well. He misses his house. He misses his dog. That because when everything happened, when the big aggression towards Lebanon happened, he was on the way. So he couldn't even take. We couldn't even take the dog with us. Every day he asked me to call the neighbors to feed the dog, but the neighbors don't exist anymore in the neighborhood. We don't know if they are safe or not. It's a blockade, and
yeah. Well, Doha.
I frankly know what will happen next. There is this fear that when I was looking at all of the videos from Gaza. The soldiers looting people's houses in Gaza and looking into their belongings. And now I don't want to see that happening to my house as well. I was always seeing those soldiers playing with the lingerie of women in Gaza.
Yeah.
I think it's humiliating and hurting to see something like that happen to your land. And I think the only way to stop this is...
a ceasefire.
National community is not able to put a diplomatic solution into action.
Yeah.
We are heading into a very dark place, and the only solution we have is to fight more for our land.
Doha, stay with us, and thank you for being with us. Let me bring Dominique in at this point. Doha, very explicit, very raw, clearly in trauma as well, given her situation with her father, her family. She's lost a cousin as well. He was a chocolatier. He was killed in a missile strike in the south. When you look at the situation, as we're talking now live, we're hearing reports of a possible ground offensive. Give me your assessment of that.
A ground offensive is a risk for Tzahal, for the Israeli army. Just remember that it's happened several times in the past. In 2006, 200 soldiers were killed, Israeli soldiers were killed, and at the end, Israel withdrew from the south of Lebanon under the umbrella of the UN resolution 1701, which never works really. And so that's why the Hezbollah were able to put in place a very strong force in the south Lebanon. And so currently, if there is a land operation, Tzahal will face these people who have been fighting. Some of them have been fighting in Syria. They are experienced soldiers, and they have planned this operation. So I think it's a risk, of course. But the problem is that Hezbollah started the war on the 8th of October, just after the Gaza attack, linking South Lebanon to Gaza. And it was asked for a long time that they will stop.
Yeah,
because that was not their war, but they preferred to continue the war like that. And so the problem is that now Israel is striking. What they will do in the short term, you're taking a small land operation, say, to destroy certain things, and then what will be the next? I mean, I was a battalion commander in 91 in South Lebanon. At that time, the south of Lebanon was occupied by Israeli forces. between the litany and the border. And finally, in 2000, they decided to withdraw.
The litany matters because you go back to the 1701 resolution, which is supposed to have come into effect after the 2006 war, the 34-day war, to which Hezbollah was supposed to withdraw 30 kilometres above the Litani River.
Exactly, but that's up to the Hezbollah to withdraw. You can understand that neither the Lebanese army nor the UNIFIL forces will fight with Hezbollah. They will just accompany the withdrawal of the Hezbollah. And so it's up to the Hezbollah to decide to withdraw from this part of Lebanon.
Am I right, Dominique? Some of your sources suggest that there could well be a ground offensive soon.
Yes, apparently some of my sources are saying that there are already special forces, Israeli special forces inside Lebanon, in order to pave the way for the ground forces. Yeah.
Miri, let me bring you in at this point, because we heard a moment ago Doha talking about where the international voices calling for peace right now. I want to listen to one of them, because a wider regional issue, the Jordanian foreign minister, the deputy prime minister as well, Ayman Safadi, had this message over the weekend to Israel. Let's take a listen.
Can you ask Israelis what's their narrative other than I'm going to continue to go to war, I'm going to kill this and kill that and destroy this and this that? The amount of damage that Israeli government has done, 30 years of efforts to convince people that peace is possible, this Israeli government killed it. The amount of dehumanization, hatred, bitterness will take generations to navigate.
Marie, your point here, two points to you, really. This from the Jordanian foreign minister. And also, if we go back to lessons of 1992, the assassination of the predecessor to Hassan Nasrallah, killed by Israeli Apache aircraft, you will well remember the organization continued to grow. So are there lessons from the past we need to heed here?
I'd like us all for a moment to take the high moral ground. And I say this from the bottom of my heart as a very liberal, progressive Israeli. Hezbollah is not the good guy. This is not about Lebanon in that sense, but it's as if there's an elephant in the room. Dominique spoke about it a bit before that. There is a terror army that has grown in Lebanon, not anywhere else. It has an immense physical capability, and it was training, as Hassan Nasrallah, the political, to me, not political leader, told us, that they were training to do what they called, he called it in his terms, Operation Liberation of the Galilee. This isn't about just, in that sense, my defense against myself. I live inside Israel. I live in the most non-perfect country on earth. I am one who goes out and protests against this government, including now, certainly throughout all of 2023. When Hezbollah joined in on October 8th, what exactly are they doing? What exactly, in that sense, am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to allow my people, my citizens, my residents, to go home when on the other side of the border you have that kind of threat? I reach out in that sense and I say, where are the voices that call out what Hezbollah is and does? And I say it in those terms because my heart goes out to Doha. Here I am sitting in Tel Aviv. And Doha, you know what Israel has done, and it seems not fair, is that we built, with money, investing, protective systems, so that all of those thousands of rockets that Hezbollah has fired at us, and also the ones that Hamas fired at us, and that Iran fired at us, we intercepted. Is it obvious? Oh, you know, Israel just does that. That impacts us. We were taught to go into safe rooms. We built for ourselves. Every single building in Israel has to have that. And so when I listen to this challenge of the Jordanian prime minister of what we need to do, I want to call out the problem. And the problem to me is not this Israeli government that I abhor. It is the fact that there is a force called Hezbollah, and we haven't yet said the term Iran and the Islamic regime and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and as a destabilizing force. You know, you said Hezbollah has capabilities and that they fought in Syria. They were fighting with Bashar Assad, for Bashar Assad, with the Islam, with the Iranian regime. Who are the good guys and the bad guys here? And I call it out. It hurts me as I listen to that, because this picture here is that the problem is Israel.
Yeah.
If Israel stops, everything becomes okay. And I disagree strongly on that.
Here's the thing, Miri. You call for the moral high ground, and yet your biggest backer, who you might appeal to, President Biden, Let's have a listen to him again today. He was setting out red lines in the past on Gaza. Those red lines, particularly when it comes to Rafah, were not met. And he's now calling again for a ceasefire. Let's have a listen to him talking to reporters today.
I will be talking to him. I'll tell you what I say to him when I talk to him.
Yes.
We really have to avoid it. We've already taken precautions relative to our embassies and personnel who want to leave. But we're not there yet, but we're working like hell with the French and many others to see the good work.
Okay, we heard Dominique a moment ago, Ketevan, call this a Gordian knot. It's an understatement, I think, given the complexities in the Middle East. Tell me where President Biden's position is right now.
Look, the Americans, at least publicly, and their message is that they're not giving up on the diplomatic solution, and they're trying their best to avoid this all-out war in the Middle East, because obviously the focus right now is on that Israel-Lebanon border and the fight between the Israeli army and Hezbollah. But, of course, we've mentioned the country, which is Iran, and that is really the risk and the fear of the Americans, is that at some point the Iranians are going to get involved way more than they are right now, which is that they are going to make this a regional war. And when you look at what the Americans are saying versus what they are doing, they are clearly saying that they're hopeful for a diplomatic solution and that they can still manage a ceasefire. But when you see the force posture of the Americans in the Middle East and the latest announcements, you're clearly seeing a country that is getting ready for the possibility that this will be a regional war. Just today, the Pentagon announced that it was sending a few thousand more troops to the Middle East, including multiple fighter jet squadrons that were supposed to replace those that were still on site. Instead, they're just going to join them. So double the air power. There are also the USS Lincoln and Truman, who are going to be at some point together in the Middle East, in that region. So two career strike force groups in the region, possibly at the same time. So the Americans are clearly, and they've said it, the Pentagon said it, this is to defend possibly U.S. interests and U.S. forces, and possibly to come to the defense of Israel, meaning if Iran does start or restart its direct attacks on Israel.
And there is a term that carries a lot of weight, mentioned by Lloyd Austin over the weekend, Secretary of Defense, saying that troops stand by, quote, ready to deploy. Talk us through the context there, because in terms of the fear it perhaps creates, or the hope for Miri and the likes in Israel that there is security, there's a lot of weight to that statement.
Absolutely, because the U.S. wants to make it clear that they will not tolerate a direct attack or a bigger one that would involve Iran on Israel. And so this is clearly a display of force that is not necessarily meant for Hezbollah, but probably more for the Iranian regime. The U.S. deployment of force, the forces that are there, the forces that are on standby, is to show that Israel is not alone, because that is even when they talk about the need for a ceasefire, the need to avoid escalation, all of that, even when they try to rein in, if you will, a little bit the Israeli operations, there is this position of the United States that they will be there to defend Israel if needed.
Dominique, just listening to that, the posturing from the US, the reassurance from the US, the messaging, optics clearly important here. If you look at what Benny Gantz was saying, former defense minister, saying that they're hoping now that this is, quote, an opportunity that they can really damage the what he called the ring of fire, the proxies, the groups that back Iran around Israel right now. Talk me through militarily what you think Israel have achieved in the past 10 or so days.
First, we have a say, if you want peace, prepare war. So that's exactly what the US are doing currently. But my personal opinion is that Iran is weak. And that's why Israel was able to fight like that against Hezbollah, because they know that Iran will not reply. Will not reply. Why?
It's a paper tiger.
Yeah, exactly. They have already in April tried to attack Israel. It was a catastrophe. Then Israel was able to strike inside Isfahan, inside Tehran, and without a reply from
the killing
Iranian.
Of Soleimani.
Yeah, exactly. And in the two last day, we saw the president elected in Iran was at the UN and have a very peaceful speech. In fact, at the UN at the UN Assembly, he was very peaceful. He wanted to talk, you know, to go back to discussion. That's the first bit. Second bit, the supreme Iranian was hiding. Because they are afraid, in fact. They know that they don't have the capacity to strike on Israel, first bit. Second bit, they know that they've got people inside the Iranian security forces who are working for Israel. That's exactly what's happened in July when they killed the Hamas leader inside Tehran. Yeah. So I think that Iran is weak. Now, we know that it is weak. That's why Israel was able to attack Hezbollah, to attack Houthi, exactly. Yesterday, there was a big attack with
several Houthis in Yemen, in Hudaydah, at the port.
And so I think you've got to prepare war, of course. But I don't think that Iran will go to war.
I want to go back to Doha in a minute. I just want to ask you this, Dominique, because if you've touched upon a number of interesting points here. First of all, the killing of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran by Israel. You talked about the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard general. The ability to strike this apartment, this bunker buster in Dahir. The threat of communications devices exploding. The number of civilians dying at the same time. Tell me about, in the intelligence community, the power that Israel and Mossad seem to hold right now, after dropping the ball, let's be said, on October the 7th.
That's an interesting point, but I'm speaking in front of a specialist of Israel intelligence. But the big difference of what Mossad is able to do and what he's doing in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, in Tehran, it's amazing capabilities, amazing. And that's is in opposition to what's happened on the 7th of October, where Israel was surprised by the attack, was not able to foresee this attack. And now, currently, Israel is trying to build up its capacity, its deterrence capacity. Now, don't try to attack us, but we will attack you. So there is a big change in 11 months. But all this job done by the Mossad is a job for years. I mean, the pager thing was probably mounted 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago and was able to attack now because there was the need and the political will to do it.
Colonel Miri Eisen, Dominique deferred to your insights, those within the community that you still talk to. Can you give us your insight on the ability of Mossad, of Israel right now, its intelligence services, compared to perhaps when you were involved?
So I'm in military intelligence inside Israel. When we talk about the security community, we talk both about the Mossad military intelligence. It's a whole community that every country has and in Israel. I'd say that over the last 2 weeks, what we've seen is when you invest over years, at the end, you do have capabilities. And perhaps I would say that the investment that Israel was looking at the northern threat, at Hezbollah, at the Iranians, at the proxies, at the end, we were ignoring and totally underestimating what Hamas was doing in the Gaza Strip. And so that colossal failure on October 7th is absolute. And what we've done over the last 2 weeks is not something that was invented 11 and a half months ago, almost 12 months ago when this started, but rather that was the main focus. So it does show that when you focus within an intelligence community on a variety of different capabilities, you're not just talking about that military operation in the immediate, what I call combat intelligence, but rather looking at the leaders, looking at the capabilities, and especially looking at what I've called a terror army. This isn't the Lebanese army. This is Hezbollah that has what is essentially one of the 10 largest arsenals in the world. And it was given to them by Iran through Syria. And so you have to use capabilities to be able to infiltrate that.
Miri, you're right. The biggest non-state military anywhere in the world, funded by 400 million to 700 million, depending on different analysts, by Iran on a yearly basis. Doha, we're getting information while I'm talking right now. Just to go to you in Lebanon, more information from the US. This is the State Department talking to reporters in the past few minutes about the possible ground operation, saying that they have, quote, informing us, the Israeli military, about a number of options, including reports of ground operations. We are having conversation about this. It's very easy for us to talk about the military strategy. You're from the south. You've lived there. You've told us about the absolute fear in Beirut right now. Just give me your thoughts when you hear that. Doha.
Actually, I will take everyone to this statement from Netanyahu in his speech to the UN in 2023. This was before October 7. At that time, Netanyahu showed the map of Greater Israel, or Israel, already annexing parts of South Lebanon. Also, it's not known that the new far wing government in Israel is always talking about the biblical land of Israel, including Lebanon, of course. So this is from Haaretz. Everybody can see it. Lebanon, part of the promised land. They are already speaking about how this far right government already have plans for Lebanon. So
your fear is it doesn't stop in the south?
While everyone talks about Israel... Sorry, can you hear me?
We can, yeah. We can hear you now.
Yeah. So everybody talks about the Israeli ability to have deterrence and their right to have self-defense. I wonder what would be any government's position if they see that there is a group already financing for settlements in South Lebanon or in their country. Like, unfortunately, you were speaking about that Hezbollah is not the Lebanese army, but what and how the international community did arm the Lebanese army, what capabilities they give him or gave that army to defend Lebanon at any point. We are a country that lived under 18 years of occupation. We exactly know how being left out and being under occupation is something that is very hurtful and harmful. And at a certain point, the world needs to realize that also Lebanon have the right to defend itself, especially when there are greats around that land.
Doha, can I ask you a point that Colonel Miri Eisen made a moment ago, talking about we are taking on the terrorists and we are defending our existential future, essentially, with the terrorists' stated aim is to destroy Israel and the Jewish population. Let me just ask you the question, Doha, which is this. This is more complicated, isn't it? We're talking about a state within a state, a militant group that has 12 seats in parliament, that has part of the cabinet, that children as young as three go to Al-Mahdi scouts, that they are given part of the social welfare that becomes the fabric of society. And you can explain clearly, if you will, just how it manifests itself as a group in everyday lives.
Actually, I'm not going to be in a position to defend Hezbollah or speak about their strategy because Hezbollah is something different.
Not to defend it, but just simply to explain the complication in Lebanon right now and how weaved it is.
The first Israeli aggression on Lebanon was in 1968. If there was no aggression in Lebanon, if there was no occupation in Lebanon, we wouldn't be dealing with Hezbollah right now. The reason Hezbollah existed in South Lebanon was the occupation in Lebanon. The reason Iran interfered in Lebanon is that they built on that conflict in Lebanon and they played the card of helping Lebanon and there was no one helping Lebanon else. So if we dealt with that problem from its roots, we wouldn't be there. If the international community at that time did intervene and did stop the invasion in Lebanon that killed 20,000 people at that time, we wouldn't be dealing with Hezbollah right now. So the international community is still doing the same mistakes over and over and over, leaving people of our Middle Eastern countries, the Arabic, that they think that are Muslims and ignorant and they don't deserve to be equal worth humans to other nations. Yeah. They leave them.
I see that.
Leave them to be scared, and then they ask them why they are fighting or why connecting to certain groups.
Miri, just listening to Doha, she makes a point very clear. Sounds like the Jordanian foreign minister when she says war has not worked. You know, 82 to 2000, 18 years of war where you had Israeli IDF soldiers in the south until they left. 2006, 34-day war. We can keep going. Ultimately, the point is there any alternative that you see? You know, the Americans, the French, we have the French foreign minister right now, Jean-Noël Barrot, saying there needs to be a ceasefire. Do you see that as a path to peace?
We all want a ceasefire. A path to peace is when you have organizations who don't call for the annihilation of the other side. My heart goes out to Doha. I have to say, though, that I'm sitting here, I'm older than you, Doha, and 24 years ago, Israel left Lebanon. And Hezbollah continues to exist, continue to grow. Hezbollah did the attack in 2006, where they kidnapped Israelis from Israeli territory. So again, it's about that framing. My heart can go out. I totally oppose this right-wing extreme government. But to show that as being, this is what Israel is about, I'm sitting here. We're not about expanding. We're right now trying to defend ourselves against something that very clearly calls for our annihilation. I would love to reach out to meet Doha to talk to people. It's not about people to people, because there are those like Hassan Nasrallah that I would listen to his weekly sermon in which I was described as something that should not exist, that Zionist entity. Zionism for me is where I live. It's who I am. It's not about Lebanon. It's about this country. And I want to hope that both of us can find a path where we can talk. But right now, I need to defend myself. And I'm worried that these kind of voices that come out say that we're the bad guy and we're the aggressor. And Hezbollah is the one that's just part of the fabric of society. And for me, that's a very challenging idea.
Miri, I'm very affected by what you say, but do you think defending yourselves goes with killing these kids?
Today, would you my like heart me to show you now the 12 pictures yeah. of the 12 but, kids but, that were killed by Hezbollah 2 weeks ago? But again, I don't want it to be about the victim.
Actually, in Lebanon, and actually in Lebanon right now, there is a huge fury on Hezbollah. And even the supporters of Hezbollah are very angry because they feel that Hezbollah was... mistake was that they were self-restraining all of this period. They were only targeting military bases. They were not responding to the aggressions in an equal way. So the numbers speak. In only 1 week, we have 2,000 people killed in Lebanon. We have 40,000 in Gaza. The unresolved stories. When Hezbollah used in 2006, or imprisoned two Israeli soldiers, it was because they wanted to liberate the Lebanese hostages that were still in Israel. Now also, Hamas is using the same excuse. Why you are in the first place keeping children and 10-year-old boys from the Palestinian territories in your prisons? If you were dealing with things the right way, we wouldn't reach that
in the
period.
Sun.
If you Mary. Have in the first place yeah. 5,000...
But I'm going to have you read the Hamas charter and the Hezbollah charter.
But I guess with Doha and Miri, we will keep going back and forth. And I know, Miri, you'll probably say next about the hostages that are still held in Gaza as well. And ultimately, let me just go across to Dominic for a minute, because it doesn't mean that those are invalid points, but those points can keep adding up over years of history. And I guess at a critical moment now, where Doha sitting in Beirut, where there may be tanks going in, where it looks, according to your sources, very likely if special forces are in Lebanon. How do you see, with your military experience, the next few days mapping out?
I think there will be a fierce battle in the south, with the Israeli trying to destroy the rest of the Hezbollah, which is still in the south. But may I just jump 2 minutes on Lebanon? Well, I know a bit Lebanon. I've been living there. I hope that because of this enormous shock of the of the killing of Mr. Nasrallah, the rest of Israel will, at the end, no longer depend on the Hezbollah. Mr. Nasrallah was the only one to decide to fight on the 8th of October, not the poor Lebanese government, because there is no Lebanese government. There is no president. And I hope that now the Lebanese will take this opportunity to rebuild a state where the Shiite, the Sunnite, and the Christian can work together and will establish, you know, it's funny, there is no border, you know, between Lebanon and Israel, only the so-called blue line, except at sea. Why? Because there was gas there, and they want to exploit the gas and have the gas. And suddenly, the Lebanese and the Israeli were able to draw the line.
And the blue line for peacekeepers for the UN, it complicates things. You have Spanish troops there now.
It's always very difficult.
Let me run this by you, Dominic, right now. What does this tell us? This is breaking news from Reuters, saying that the Israeli military has considered now a closed military zone of areas of Misgav, Matula, and Kfar Giladin in northern Israel. Does that suggest we're about to see an offensive?
Yes, probably. And this will increase because you can't. If you want to fight in the south of Lebanon, you've got to go up to the Litani because all the Hezbollah soldiers are there and with their weapons. So you will not go only in a small part. You'll have to go up to the Litani, and that's another problem for the Tzahal.
Miri, another point that you touched upon, you said, you know, you're not a fan of the right-wing element of the Netanyahu government, Mrs. Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, and yet we're seeing the government expanding, a former opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu going within that cabinet. Where do you see Benjamin Netanyahu's position now? Because of what happened with Nasrallah, has he solidified himself in place?
My first reaction after the elimination of Nasrallah, even before we got the absolute confirmation that he was dead, is that this helps Prime Minister Netanyahu. I said I very much oppose the right-wing government, and I'm not a fan of my own prime minister. And all I can say is I look at both France and Italy, at Spain and at the UK, and I think that we all have a lot of challenges right now within our democracies between what we call right-wing and left-wing. But in Israel, add into it the conflict, let alone the messianic aspects that Doha was talking about before. So I think it helps him. Right now, it makes him stronger. Having said that, it's very hard to know right now where Israeli politics will go until the hostages come home.
It's a very brief word with Ketevan. As with Ketevan, this is a moment of deep anxiety for the White House right now.
Absolutely. And there is something that has to be said, because obviously the focus right now is on the Middle East. But you can't separate the reactions and the positions of the U.S. president right now with the fact that there is an election in about a month's time. And whether the situation or his comments would have been different if there was no election, I don't know that. But there is the reality that this is a campaign, that there is a Democrat running against a Republican right now, that Joe Biden, anything he says will be associated with the Vice President, Kamala Harris, who is running. And there is this idea in the White House that they don't want to say anything one way or another that could be used or to the detriment or to cause a problem for Kamala Harris in this campaign. And there is, of course, this question of the support for Israel, because it plays in both ways. For the Democrats, it's very complicated right now. It's all about striking a balance between the support for Israel, because they have a large group of Jewish voters in the United States, and those supporters of the Democrats who are Muslims, who are from Arab countries, and who see this and who are complaining that the Democrats are not looking on the other side.
Okay, Ketevan Kojistani, thank you so much. We are at a moment where it appears there may well be a ground offensive, according to CBS, Washington Post, a military zone closed, according to Reuters, north of Israel. We're going to keep you across this. Thank you for watching the debate tonight. Thank you, Ketevan Kojistani, our international affairs editor, Dominic Trinchan, former head of the French military mission to the UN, Colonel Miri Eisen in Tel Aviv tonight, former IDF deputy head of combat intelligence, and of course, especially to Doha Sabah, a displaced resident in Beirut. Thank you all. Stay tuned, and we'll be back tomorrow with the debate.